I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Being an informed and savvy patient and healthcare consumer is important, and we're reminded of that in a new book, 10 Questions You Must Ask Your Doctor. We've heard of scandals about the side effects of drugs, overcrowding in hospitals, and the trouble of finding a family doctor. Thus, we need to be proactive as well as skeptical when it comes to what doctors tell us when we're in their office. Armed with these 10 questions, we will confidently maneuver the modern medical system. I am joined now by one of the book's authors, Ray Moynihan. He and Melissa Sweet have written this book that tells us the downsides of medical testing and more. He has covered the business of healthcare for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the Australian Financial Review, and the British Medical Journal. He is co-author of Selling Sickness, How the World's Biggest Pharmaceutical Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients. He joins me from Byron Bay, Australia this day. The book is published by Greystone. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Ray Moynihan. Good morning, Mr. Moynihan.
Hello, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. Someone might say, Ray, that you're cynical when it comes to healthcare, what with your previous book and this one. Are you?
Cynical, that's a good question. Look, I'm certainly skeptical. I'm very skeptical. Cynical sometimes, yes. I have to admit that I'm cynical about a lot of the commercial considerations that seem to drive a lot of medical practice. Yes, reporting on this area for 10 to 15 years, writing several books, I have become cynical, but let me say that I have enormous amounts of faith as well to balance that cynicism, because there are just so many wonderful practitioners within medicine. There are so many valuable drugs. There are so many valuable pieces of medical technology. And there are such good people trying to run a rational system that I also have a lot of faith. So yes, there's cynicism, but there's faith as well.
So you're not someone that goes to Eastern medicine practitioners or traditional medicine practitioners. You do go to the doctor. Did you go regularly?
Well, I don't know about regularly. I do go to doctors when the need arises, and sometimes complementary medicine, is the way to go as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's about applying skepticism as much as you can to whatever form of healthcare that you choose to partake in.
So when we deal with the modern medical system, we shouldn't assume that the doctor knows best, right?
Absolutely not. And I think a lot of people already don't assume that. I mean, many of us might have been brought up in that very, very old-fashioned authoritarian sort of mindset where the doctor knew best, we were the patient, and we just took the doctor's word for it. Now, sadly, a lot of doctors, particularly older doctors, are still in that mindset, and when you meet one of those sort of older, more arrogant, out-of-touch physicians, it can be very frustrating, and I'm sure you and other people listening know exactly what we're talking about, and those sorts of attitudes really get in the way of a good patient-doctor interaction. But increasingly, physicians, doctors, other specialists, other health professionals know how to listen and how to communicate, and so this book is really about trying to encourage that conversation and try and inform that conversation and have consumers or patients or people ask questions before they decide to undergo serious intervention or to take drugs, potentially lifelong drugs.
How did you and Melissa come together to write this book?
Melissa Sweet is another journalist. We're both Australian health journalists, but both with something of an international reputation. We write and work for people all over the world. Melissa, like me, has been reporting on healthcare for a very long time. I think she's been in the game, must be close to two decades now. And I think she, like me, saw a need for a basic book for consumers that really introduced them to some of the controversies going on in the world of medicine in a way that people would understand and would be accessible. As health journalists, we discover all kinds of controversies all the time that don't get enough attention, and we thought it was time to bring people into that conversation.
At my own doctor, whenever something comes up, you know, you need a cream or you need a prescription or something like that, he always seems to have a sample of whatever he's prescribing me. Now, one of the interesting things that you write about in the book is that the doctors have some sort of, you know, interest other than your own, and that that they're beholden perhaps to the pharmaceutical industry. Is there a connection there when a doctor gives you a sample in his office, where that comes from? Should you wonder where that comes from?
Look, Joe, I think you should wonder where that comes from. I mean, the free sample thing is a tricky one because obviously a free sample helps you out in the sense that you don't have to pay for it. But free samples are one of the major marketing strategies of the pharmaceutical industry. And we all know now that pharmaceutical industry companies exert way more influence over GPs and physicians than they should. And one of the questions that we think people should be routinely asking of their doctors is who else is profiting here? Who else is making money out of this? If a doctor prescribes a drug, these days you've really got to ask, you know, when was the last time the manufacturer of that drug took that doctor to lunch? When was the last time they went to an educational seminar funded by the manufacturer of that drug? Now, we're not suggesting you ask these questions every time, but certainly if you have a relationship with a physician, it would be good to know whether they are the sort of doctor that exposes themselves to drug company marketing regularly, or whether they're the sort of doctor who said, no, I no longer see drug reps because I'm sick and tired of being misled, or no, I don't go to medical education events funded by industry because I like to get independent education. These sorts of conversations are going to be happening a lot more as we've discovered the extent of drug company influence over physicians all over the world.
And that, how pervasive is that? Does that happen? It doesn't matter if it's in Australia or Canada or the United States. That happens everywhere, does it?
It happens everywhere. There's a country, you know, not far south of you that where it happens an enormous amount. I mean, and the U.S. is really the epicenter of pharmaceutical company influence over physicians, but it is a global phenomenon, and indeed there is a rigorous debate going on within the world of medicine about trying to disentangle from the influence of pharmaceutical companies. The British Medical Journal, where I write regularly, is running all sorts of articles about this, as are many medical journals everywhere in Canada and the US and everywhere else, really expressing alarm about the closeness between doctors and drug companies, and how on earth to untangle that closeness. Things like medical education, there's a real debate about this at the moment. The ongoing medical education that doctors receive once they leave university, a lot of that education is funded by the industry, and a lot of doctors are no longer happy with that situation, and so they're looking for other ways to fund it. But the question is who will pay for that, and people, a lot of doctors are reluctant to pay for their own lunch when they go to an educational seminar. So these things are very live controversies everywhere, and I think from our point of view as patients, when we think as patients or as consumers, the way it affects us is that prescribing decision really in my interest, or has it been driven by this massive marketing machine, often hidden from us? And that's the question we have to reflect on a little bit more.
Has it been your experience that doctors like us to question them? Armed with these 10 questions, do you think that the doctors like it, that we ask them these things?
It depends, Joe, very much on the doctor. It depends very much on the mindset of the doctor. Some doctors do like engaging in these sorts of interactions, but a lot of people find it hard. And I think that, you know, just think of your own experience. You know that that sometimes it's going to be easy to ask some tough questions, and sometimes the vibe you get from your healthcare professional is that they don't want you to ask anything apart from a couple of rudimentary questions. So if you start asking tough questions about where's the evidence, or what are the side effects, or, you know, are you do you have some sort of financial relationship with that drug company that makes that drug, then it makes for potentially a difficult interaction. And this is the reality, I suppose. If people are going to ask more questions, sometimes they're going to upset their providers. But, you know, we take the view that if your healthcare provider is not ready for some of those questions, then maybe you should be looking elsewhere anyway. But you're right, the reality here is a lot of people won't be ready to hear these questions, but we think it's well past time to start asking them.
And then there's a problem, of course, I'm sure you encounter this, that it is hard to find a doctor nowadays, isn't it?
It can be. I mean, it depends very much on where you live, and it depends very much on the sort of supply in your area. The Canadian system is a little different from other systems in the sense that the public nature of your healthcare system is still very dominant, and that carries enormous amounts of benefits. But perhaps one of the downsides is that in particular parts of the country at particular times, you might have to wait a little longer to see someone. But again, in my view and the evidence I've seen suggests that downside is far outweighed by many of the benefits that you get from having a universal publicly funded healthcare system. In Australia, we have a slightly larger private sector, and so in the capital cities here, for example, in Australia, you can usually get to see a doctor very quickly, depending on where you live. Whether that doctor is a good doctor and someone you want to see more regularly, that's the big question.
In the book, do you recommend that we go for second opinions?
We certainly do, and we certainly do, particularly if it involves a serious intervention that's being proposed. Let's say something surgical. Just for a short-term course of drugs or something, it's probably not necessary to have a second opinion. It's certainly necessary these days to try and do your own research, to try and ask the doctor, where is the evidence? Do I really have this disorder that you're suggesting? Do I really have this problem? Do I really need this treatment? What are the side effects of it? And where's the evidence so I can look myself at this? Those sorts of questions really should become standard. In certain situations, for major surgery, absolutely a second or even a third opinion can be very valuable. The book is not saying that surgery is not valuable. I mean, surgery at times is extremely valuable. Lifelong medication is, for some people, extremely valuable, life-saving, and critically important. So the book is not anti-medicine or anti-doctor. It's really about ramping up that skepticism. And yes, a second opinion can be very, very helpful, and sometimes a third.
Well, the first question that you write about in the book, and I think it's quite interesting and necessary, is do I really need that test? And you cite examples of for example, CT scans, that too many scans gives us the opportunity to, opens up the opportunity for small risk of cancer. Is that right?
That's right, Joe. that when we were researching the book, I was shocked by the extent of concern within the community of radiologists, you know, the doctors who work with these tests. There is increasing, I'm going to say, alarm within the radiologist community about the number of CT scans that people are having. There has been an attitude in recent years, a very cavalier attitude, too often, where CT scans have been recommended far too quickly. And there is increasing concern now about the cumulative effects, about the size of the doses that people are getting and the possibility of increased risks of cancer as a result. And certainly I think you'll be hearing a lot more about this. I think that governments will be moving on this point. But at this point, people need to say, do I really need that CT scan, or it's also known as a CAT scan, do I really need that? And this is particularly important when it comes to children. There's been some research, and we cite it in the book, out of Canada a few years ago now, but suggesting that the way in which CT scans are used with kids is can be very inappropriate. There's a real sense that often we don't know how big the dose is, the dose of radiation that's going into the body from these machines. There's a real need for skepticism there. But I think more than that, with the example of CT scans, there's a need for government intervention to really start raising awareness among both physicians and the general population about the dangers of CT scans. A great example of a powerful piece of technology that can have some powerful downsides as well.
And as far as you can see, urine and blood tests, frequent tests of that nature, those aren't cause for alarm, are they?
Well, look, it depends very much on what sort of test you have. I think we all have a view, Joe, that a simple blood test couldn't hurt you. I mean, how on earth could a little blood test hurt you? Well, we take the view that a test result can open up the pathway to a lot of other treatments and tests. And so we say that it's worth thinking seriously even before a simple blood test. So one of the most controversial tests is a PSA test. This is a test many people will be familiar with. It's one of the tests they use to determine if men have prostate cancer. Now, having a simple blood test, a simple PSA test, is actually quite a significant step to take, because it could start you on a chain of other tests and treatments. And the evidence around PSA tests is very controversial, and it's worth finding out about. So even simple tests are worth thinking a lot about, and are worth asking, do I really need that test? If I have the test, what are the sort of options at the end of it if I turn out to have something positive or negative? And so we don't think that blood tests should be ignored. We think that the same sort of skepticism should be brought to bear there.
And what about breast cancer screening? You write about that in the book.
Breast cancer screening, we use breast cancer screening as an example where there is good evidence that breast cancer screening does seem to save lives. And because of that good evidence, it has been funded all over the world. So having said that, though, if you read the literature around breast cancer screening, you will also find that there are some researchers in the world who have looked very, very closely at that evidence, and they raise questions, and they say, well, yes, there does seem to be a positive benefit overall from breast cancer screening, but the benefit is so small, it could be outweighed by the risks. In other words, the risks of radiation and so on from the screening techniques. So even with breast cancer screening, which really, you know, should be considered a screening strategy that does have benefits, even with that, there are questions within the medical literature about it. So it's worth thinking about, and in fact, there are decision aids now. That's one of the things the book talks about. There are decision aids online for people to go to and to check out to help them think through these things. And again, remember that age is very important with breast cancer screening. A lot of the evidence suggests that women over 50 can benefit from regular screening. If women are under 50 years old, it's a different story, and the benefits there, if they're there, are much smaller.
So really what we should take away from this book is that as a healthcare consumer, we need to be more savvy, we need to be more engaged. I'm in my late 20s. Should I go for regular checkups, or, I mean, I really should be more circumspect, shouldn't I, about myself when I go to the doctor, right?
Joe, I can't answer that question because, I can't give advice, and I won't. I'm really a journalist. I'm a very simple journalist with a lot of humility in this respect. I have written a lot about medicine. I've read more medical journal articles than I care to remember, and written quite a few too. So my comments and thoughts and my books are informed by that, but I can't give individual recommendations. But what I can say is that, yes, we all, whatever age we are, we all need to be much more skeptical, not just about the recommendations that are given to us, but about whether we need to be going so regularly. And I think this notion of the regular checkup also needs to be questioned. I know that that's almost heretical to suggest that, but I certainly do think that the notion of the regular checkup with a particular GP needs to be questioned, because often in the past, those sorts of checkups have led to interventions that may themselves be unnecessary, and so yes, I think a dose of skepticism is what we all need.
Ray, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about this book. It is a necessary and important one, and I do suggest people pick it up.
Joe, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. The book is called 10 Questions You Must Ask Your Doctor. It's published by Greystone, co-authored with Melissa Sweet. Ray Moynihan on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.